Women have been playing football for more than 150 years, and it's always been political. Some have been celebrated, but others have been ridiculed, criticized, and forgotten. This is the Forgotten 11, the hidden history of women's football.
I'm not going to the White House. No.
You know, there was a lot of critics talking about us about way back, so I suck on that one.
Give me the effing ball.
Playing like a girl means you're a badass.
Hi, I'm Chris McGlynn. Welcome to The Forgotten 11. Just after I released the last episode of The Forgotten 11, I got a message from Signor Marco Gianni. You'll remember he's the historian of the Gruppo Femminile Calcistico of Milan. I know I promised an episode on the Matildas, and we'll get there. But today, Marco Gianni joins us from Milan to, among other things, correct my pronunciation of Italian and tell us more about this team. There are just a couple points where the connection fails, so I jump in and kind of finish his sentences. Enjoy.
My name is Marco Gianni, and I am an Italian history and geography teacher. And during my free time, I'm still doing some academical research, and some years ago I found this very interesting history, this hidden history, that was the story of the first ever female football team in Italy. It was called Gruppo Calcistico Femminile, that means female football club, football group. And so I started my search, because we can say that anybody before ever studied this story. And so I started to read the newspaper of that time. And after that, I even started to search for the heirs of the calciatrici. Calciatrici is women footballers. Mm-hmm. So I found some of them, the sons or even the grandsons of those players, because all the players were from Milan. Because here in Milan there was some 30, 40, even 50 girls playing, and so you know that they had a lot of heirs, and I was lucky because I found three or four of them. And it was very interesting because even if no one of those girls, of those women, ever wrote or gave an interview about this story, the fact is that inside the families, this story has been told for many years as a sort of private, private history.
So, can you tell me what Italy was like in 1932 under Mussolini? What was the danger or the challenges for these girls?
Yeah, the fact was that before the fascism, because as you know, Mussolini took the power between 1922 and 1925. So we can say that in 1933, which is the year that the girls start playing, the fascist regime had a strong power on the Italian people. The fact is that before the fascism regime, we can say that there was no women's sports in Italy. I can say that before 1920s, just very few women from the high society could play, you know, some tennis or some horse riding. Okay, but with the fascist regime, Mussolini was the people around Mussolini were willing to spread the practice of women's sports because they thought that sports could lead to better bodies for the Italian women, because you know that Mussolini wanted Italian women to give birth to more and more babies in order to have some soldiers in the future, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we can say that sports was a sort of
a tool for eugenics
for the regime. And so thanks to this fact, the Italian regime started to make girls playing sports, but that sports was just female sports. That means that meant during that time tennis, swimming, and athletics.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that there was no team sports for girls, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the regime tried to spread out the basketball and not football. Why? Because in the Italia, for the Italian people, football was just immense sport. I mean, it was too much, you know, it was too much linked to the masculine identity. And the problem was that during that time, a lot of girls went to go to the stadium to see the football matches, I mean, to see the male football matches. And so Milan, in 1933, a group of football fans started to play, you know. And so you can see that there was this sort of ideological blackout, because on one hand, the regime wanted the girls to practice sports, okay? But on the other part, those girls said something like, okay, now we played all the female sports you wanted, okay? We are football fans, so now the next step is we want to play football, okay? Mm-hmm. So I mean that it's very interesting, because after that, after the foundation of the team, the problem was that Italia, that fascist leaders such as Leandro Finati could not say anything, because the problem was that they gave birth to that experiment. And the fact is that if you read all the letters that those players wrote to Italian sport newspapers, they introduced themselves as a fascist girl.
I've read a couple of your papers where you talk about how clever the girls were when they wrote. Can you tell me more about the letters and how they were written?
The letters, yeah, because there was one girl, which name is Losanna Strigaro, who was the segretaria, that means the secretary of the group, and she was a sort of spokeswoman of the group, because you know that during the first weeks, we're talking about February 1933, all the Italian, the girls started to wrote some letters, you know, to introduce their experiment. And the fact is that a lot of Italian newspapers published those letters then, you know, but just for joke, just to say, you know, that this was a ridiculous thing. But the fact that a lot of times all these girls started a sort of polemics with the Italian newspaper, defending their own right to play football. So we can see that there was, I mean, they were not only brave, but I can say really clever, because they understood that it was an ideological fight that they had to play. And in fact, on late March, we can say on the beginning of April, Leandro Finati, the second man of the fascist regime. He was even the leader of Italian sport, of Italian sport, sporting federation. Arpinati gave them the official permission to play, but he say you can play football just for experiment, but you don't, you cannot play in public. Mm. I think your matches should be hidden from the public, and we can say that. For the very first months, girls did it. I mean that they play just for their parents, for their sisters and brothers, and just for their female friends. Okay. Mm-hmm. But the fact that was that after that, some months later, in June and in July, 1933. They started to play in public, and they play towards an audience of 100 people in Milan in July 1933. And the fact was that at this second match in Milan, among the audience, there were even the players of Football Club Internazionale, of Inter Club. And so we can say that, you know, even the male player of the city went to see these brave girls playing football.
Was that because they had not been playing in public before? Was that very dangerous for them?
Well, I can say that was very dangerous. The problem was that, you know, if you play football and if you are 20, 30 girls, you cannot hide yourself, okay? So you must have some kind of permission, okay? And the fact that was that during the first week, they had some link with the local teams, I mean, with local amateur teams, and also with the local sporting fascist groups, and so we can say that they play in different field in Milan City, okay? Because there was, you know, this sort of sympathy for them by the Milanese sporting movement, okay? But the problem was that, in order to play, they had to have some permission. In fact, in October, when the regime decided to ban the Italian football movement, the fact was just that they had no more field to play. And for example, because you know that during the summertime, there was this problem. During the summertime, there were two big problems. The first was that just in May 1933, Arpinati, which, as I said before, which was their patron, we can say, in Rome, lose all his power. And you can say that the first problem was that they had no more any patron in Rome in order to defend them. The second problem was that in September, a second group of women footballers raised in Alessandria, a city near Turin, and the players from Alessandria and the players from Milan managed to play the very first Italian football match in Alessandria. And this match had to be played in Alessandria on October the 1st, 1933. But just 2 days before the match, the local magistrate banned this match. What just recalling the fact that no one in Italy, no Italian women had the permission to play in public. And you can say that after just 2 or 3 months later, we can say that there was no more football team in Italy, because meanwhile, the regime, we can say, that invited the football players to...
Because meanwhile, the regime invited the football players to play other sports like gymnastics, track and field, basketball.
That all this adventure took place, in just 10 months, you can say, from February 1933 until December, December. Mm. I mean, in Alessandria, maybe some months more. We can say there was a very short adventure. And then we have to wait for more than 10 years.
And then we have to wait more than 10 years for women's football to be reborn in Italy.
In just after the war, after the liberation.
So. Mm. Now, I did read some, and I don't remember where I read this, but in the summer of 1933, there were many teams, maybe not formal, maybe not as organized as the girls in Milan, but I did read that because of the letter writing, women all over Italy became interested in playing football.
We can see. We can say that in summer, that summer, there was the Italian group. The group in Milan. In Milan, there were 3 teams because there were a lot of girls. Okay, so they in the summer there were even 50 girls. Okay, so they have they could play among them. Okay, so there were, we can say, this group in Milan. Then in September, born the second group in Alessandria. Okay, in Alessandria there were just 11 girls. Okay, no more 11. And we can say that in Alessandria, this girl played with kids, with male kids, because there weren't enough to play among them. And we can say that there were no. I mean, at the moment, there is no historical proof that other teams raised in Italy.
Okay,
they tried to raise a group in Rome, but they failed. Okay, and probably they tried even in Bologna, in Turin, in Venice, but there is no historical fact that they really did it. Okay.
Okay.
So we can say that probably on October the regime decided to ban because they saw that the football the women football movement was spreading around the nation, around the country. Okay,
mm-hmm.
We can say that for them was very important to ban everything as soon as possible. Okay, because you know that if you manage a match, you know, in Alessandria with a team coming from Milan, that there is no more private football. Okay,
right.
It is very public. It's so public.
So, do you think? I mean, the impression that I get is women all over Italy are really interested. Do you think because it became so public that later, when after the war, women start playing, do you think that this team and their letter rating campaign might have inspired that?
No, I don't think so, just because those 1933 girls were really forgotten, because, you know, even from September, from 1933, there was a sort of media silence about them. We can say that until July 1933, the Italian newspaper are full of news about those women. And the fact that if you read all the Italian newspaper in the year later, in the fascist era, in the fascist years, there is no more news about them. I mean, there are just, we can say, 9 or 10 quotation about them. The fact was that the regime was really successful in let the people forget this story. Mm-hmm. So when the Italian football women football movement start again in 1945, 1946, the new players say that they were the first girls to play football in Italy. Okay, mm-hmm. So you know that there was it was really a sort of silence because and they were forgotten from by everyone, we can say. And mm-hmm. the fact is that for me what's most striking is that even the 1933 players, they didn't tell anyone their story after that. I mean, mm-hmm. After the liberation, when the, mm-hmm. when there is no more fascists in Italy. Probably because they didn't think that what they lived was important. And I mean that for me, this is very striking, but it's not so striking if you think that, for example, a lot of women who joined the Italian resistance, who became partisans in 1943, 1945, after the war, they just they didn't tell anyone their stories. You know that at that time, women were, they were not accustomed to tell their own stories. Because they were convinced, we can say by the mentality that what they need was not history, and so I think that this is a very big problem even for the Italian movement. And the fact that a lot of times the Italian women football movement. Born and then died and then reborn again, such as if it was always the first time. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And I think that it's very interesting because you know that if you don't have any collective memory, I mean you cannot fight because you don't have any history before you that could help you, for example.
Right. I found an article which maybe it was something you sent me, but it's an article about the Women's Defense Group of the Partisans, and the woman Giovanni, and I apologize if I got her name wrong, Giovanna Boccolini Barcelona.
Boccolini.
She was the older sister to several of the players, and she was a writer for one of their papers calling for women's equality after the war.
Giovanna was coming from this family, the Boccolini family, who moved to Milan in 1927 from Lodi, which is a country city near Milan. The Boccolini were two brothers and then five sisters. They were a socialist family, and we can say so. Of course, they were anti-fascist. And Giovanna could not play because she was married, and we can say that this was the mentality for that times, even in athletics, in swimming, married women could not play. Okay, any kind of sports, but Giovanna helped her three younger sisters. Okay, were Luisa, Marta, and Rosetta. Rosetta was just 16, and so we can say that Giovanna could not play, but she helped the team. And she was at that time Giovanna had a son and a daughter. During the war in 1943, she became a partisan. Okay, and she helped a lot. Sorry, a partisan for the Communist Party, okay, here in Milan, and she helped a lot of people to escape to Switzerland. For example, English soldiers or Jews and so on. And during the war, she founded with other women in Milan the first ever women partisan group, okay, who was called Gruppi di Difesa della Donna. And after the war, she became a politician. And she was elected twice for the Italian Communist Party here in Milan as a city councillor. And we can say that she managed about youth assistance and schools and so on. Mm-hmm. And the fact is all, so we can say that you can see a link between what she did in 1933 and her later life. That was that she had this managing skills, okay? Mm-hmm. And so you can say that she cannot use these skills during 1933 to fight against the regime, of course.
Sure.
And but she used it to help her sisters to build a small place of freedom, we can say, because mm-hmm. During those times, Italian women could not be free in Italy. They had no rights. They had no political rights. They have no working rights. But the fact was that sport was a small place of freedom for women at those times. And the fact is that some year later, 1938 and 1939, Giovanna helped her little daughter, Grazia, to play skating, ice skating here in Milan. And the fact is that Grazia later became one of the most important ice skater in Italy. She joined the 1948 St. Moritz Winter Olympics as for the Italy, of course. And so you can say that sport in Boccalini family, Boccalini and then Barcellona, Barcellona is the name of Giovanni's husband. Sport was very important for the women as a space of freedom, a space also of emancipation.
Wow.
Then we can say that we should also talk about Rosetta, the younger Boccalini sister, because after the after the closing of the football team, she started to play basketball, and then she was really successful in it, because she played for the Ambrosiana team. Ambrosiana at that time was the name of Internazionale, because mm-hmm. Internazionale had also a women basketball team. Okay, and mm-hmm. Rosetta win for 3 years in late 30s. The Italian national team. So she became even Rosetta was a teacher, okay, but during her free time she played basketball. And this was really interesting because during that time Italian sporting women such as basketball players had, for example, the opportunity to travel in Italy. This was very, very different from the life that Italian girls did. I mean, they could travel, they could meet people, and but the problem was that Rosetta was a young teacher, so Harris told me that even if she played in Turin or in Trieste or in Bologna and during the Sunday, on each each Monday morning she had to be in class in school because she had class with her children. She was teacher in a elementary school, and the problem was that this elementary school was very far from Milan, in Nosadello, a very little village in the country, and Nosadello was 30 kilometers far from Milan, and she had to travel by bike. So you can imagine that she played in Turin on Sunday, then she came home, and then on Monday morning she had to cycle for 30 kilometers to be at 8 a.m. in class with her children, with her students.
Okay. Yeah.
So we can say that she had a very full life for that time. She did a lot of things. She visited a lot of Italian cities. So this was a sort of freedom that I was talking about. And the other fact was that basketball, as football, you can see that it's a team sport. So you can see that there is a group of girls, of women, which can talk together. We can also think together about what the regime told them. So you can see that it's quite different from, for example, Ondina Valla's story, because Ondina Valla is as Italian athletics woman, was alone. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's a private space where they can sort of be in public together alone.
Yeah. But you know that if you play together with your basketball or football teammates, of course there is a community, and so you can see that in that community, no one man could enter.
Right.
So, even if coaches were men, not women, of course, but you know that I think that a football team was really a sort of danger for the regime, because no one could control what was happening inside the community.
Right. Thank you very much for giving me a few minutes of your time. Do you have anything that you'd like to add?
I'm thinking about it. Is the I don't know. Actually, I don't know.
Again, thank you so much, and please keep in touch.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Thank you for listening to me.
As always, thank you for listening. If you'd like to see more about this team and the teams we've covered on previous episodes, please join the Slack channel. It's free and everyone's welcome. If you'd like to help with research or have a story of the hidden history of women's football, the Slack channel is where we start. You can follow Marco on Twitter at calciatrice1933 and follow this show, Forgotten XI. Check the show notes for links to both of those. And whatever holidays you celebrate, I hope you have a great one. If you enjoy the show and you'd like to give the show a gift, the best thing you can do is share with friends and through social media, or leave a review. The best way I can find more stories is to have a bigger audience. So we both win, right? Now, I try to get a show out every 2 weeks, if you've been paying attention. But with the holidays, it may be a little bit longer this time, but I'm not going anywhere. See you next time.